My name is Philip Yanos. I'm a professor, mental health advocate, and New Yorker. Welcome to Exiles in the City, a podcast focused on topics related to the treatment of marginalized groups in urban areas. The podcast takes inspiration from my book, Exiles in New York City, Warehousing the Marginalized on Ward's Island, which was published by Columbia University Press this past April. The book can be ordered online and found at local bookstores in New York. Thank you for tuning in. I'm honored to welcome Stacey Horn as my third guest today. Stacey is a long-term New Yorker, published author, journalist, and musician. She's the author of 7 books, including the brand new book, The Killing Fields of East New York, The First Subprime Mortgage Scandal, A White-Collar Crime Spree, and The Collapse of an American Neighborhood. And I've recently bought and I've started reading it. Stacey is also known as the founder of Echo NYC, one of the first online social media platforms during the early idealistic days of the internet. And I remember hearing about it when it was happening, although I was not on it. And she wrote a book about that time called Cyberville, Clicks Culture and the Creation of Online Town. Most relevant to this podcast, in 2018, she published a book called Damnation Island, Poor, Sick, Mad, and Criminal in 19th Century New York, which discussed the history of Blackwell's Island, present-day Roosevelt Island, an island in the East River whose history both parallels and diverges from that of Ward's Island, the topic of my book. Since it was used as the location for multiple institutions of groups that the New York City government wished to keep away from the city during the 1800s. But interestingly, it stopped serving in that capacity by the start of the 20th century. So I encourage you to read it if you haven't had a chance to yet. Thank you so much for joining me, Stacey.
Great to be here.
Okay. So let's start by talking about what got you interested in writing about Blackwell's Island and why you think it was an important story to tell, both for New York and for the world in general.
Well, for some reason, I have always had this obsession with forgotten stories and forgotten people and the need to resurrect them. I mean, who knows what that's about? But I lost one of my oldest friends recently, and I was thinking about, like, you know, for years and years, you know, we've had phone calls, exchanged letters, and poured our hearts out to each other about all the things that were very important to us. And I was thinking about how, you know, soon that'll all be gone, you know, She'll be forgotten, I'll be dead and forgotten. And it's sad, but that's okay. I mean, that's life. There's no injustice to either of us. But terrible things happened to the people that ended up on Blackwell's Island. And they had lives and friends and family and things that were just as important to them. But not only, you know, are they gone and forgotten, but what was done, it's like what was done to them on Blackwell's Island never happened. And that matters. Their stories are important to New York and to the world because we should know what was done so that we never have anything like that happen again.
Yeah, so it sounds like your motivation was kind of similar to mine in that there's this sense of responsibility to honor, you know, the stories of people who are kind of left out, right?
Yes.
You know, and the history of New York has been told from many perspectives, but it generally glosses over this part of things, the institutions, right? Maybe only some of the more, you know, kind of widely discussed things like, you know, 10 days in a madhouse or whatever have gotten talked about, but not really the inside of like, what was it really like in there? Which is what you get into.
And that was really hard to find out. And I'm sure you had the same experience researching Ward's Island. I mean, if you're researching the lives of the well-to-do, there's tons of records left. And you don't have to guess about how they felt or thought. You know, they kept diaries, books were written about them, articles. You know, there's just so much material. But if you try to research the kind of people that ended up on Ward's and Blackwell's Island, you know, you're putting together scraps. It's a challenge.
So something I wanted to ask specifically about was how in your book you talk about how conditions on the Blackwell's Island Asylum, right? So one of the institutions there was the first public insane asylum, right, of New York City. And so you talk about how conditions deteriorated almost immediately after it was opened in 1839. And that one of the reasons for this was that it was under the management of the same people who ran the city jail, which was also on the island. So, you know, this is kind of, it might seem bizarre now that they would have both managed by the same department. And now we have Department of Corrections and Department of Mental Health. But, you know, there is kind of like this toxic, you know, connection between the two. So can you say more about how this worked and you know, and what was so problematic about this?
Well, I want to just give a little bit of a backstory first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
The city had a public lunatic asylum. And we all know Bellevue, the public hospital. I think most people are aware of Bellevue, the public hospital. But it used to also be the site for the lunatic asylum. Mm-hmm. The almshouse for the poor, and also the penitentiary and the workhouse. And as a result, the condition, it was overcrowded, the conditions were horrendous, and the city recognized this. And they originally started with the best of intentions. They realized, okay, we botched this terribly, we have to fix this. And so they bought Blackwell's Island with the idea that they would rebuild all these institutions and correct the mistakes that they had made. And they did their research. They went and visited modern, I know it's saying modern lunatic asylums out here, but that's what they were called at the time. But they researched all the modern treatments at the time for mental health and they considered how they would build the buildings to be more humane. I mean, and putting them on Blackwell's Island wasn't so much about getting them, you know, out of sight and out of mind. Blackwell's Island at the time was this very lush pastoral island, and they just thought it would be more humane to keep them there on this island with flowers and fruit trees rather than on Manhattan, which could be cold and indifferent, especially to people like them. And it just went south almost immediately, and for a variety of reasons. And one of them is that the one that you already brought up, that it was run by two separate, which what you would think would be two separate groups, charities and incarceration. You know, I'm not an expert on the 18th or 17th centuries, but so I suspect we've always been moving this way, but it created this association between putting, you know, convicts and mentally ill people together, created this association that they were somehow one and the same, that poor people were thieves in disguise, the mentally ill were to be feared, and they were all in some way, shape, or form guilty of something. They belonged together away from us, and it just cemented this feeling and the criminalization of the poor.
And you know, the co-location of the almshouse and the asylum is sort of parallel to what's happening on Ward's Island now, where there's these shelters and the hospital and the community residences are all there together. So that's kind of, you know, it's sort of continued in some ways in that way. But putting corrections, you know, on its own island, you know, was another development, right? So we have Rikers Island, you know, where it's just where the sort of the descendant of what was on Blackwell's Island at the time, right?
But I just want to say the biggest problem was money. They never spent enough money, and they made decisions to cut corners and spend less money that led to the horrors and the abuses that I wrote about. I mean, things like instead of hiring attendants and nurses, they used convicts from the workhouse to look after the mentally ill.
Right. And there were many stories of brutalization. Similarly, you know, there were ones that I encountered, you know, in the asylum that was located on Ward's Island, you know, and it wasn't until sometime after the first few years of the establishment of the asylum on Ward's Island that they kind of made a decision to stop hiring inmates, you know, as attendants. But that led to a staffing problem, right? They couldn't find anybody then, right? So because they weren't paying people.
Exactly.
Adequately. Yeah. 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 So
and that was true of everybody. They weren't paying the doctors enough, so they weren't getting the best doctors, and it's just all down the line.
Mm-hmm.
They'd get recent graduates. That's who they usually employed.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess sort of thinking about this in the present day, I mean, the parallels that I sort of think about is like, well, we still send the police as, you know, kind of the first line for mental health crisis, right, in the city, right? So that's kind of adding in the justice system involvement, right? And there's still a lot of people who are located, you know, at Rikers Island, who have, you know, what are, you know, diagnosed mental health conditions. And there's a lot of concern about not only how that affects them, but from my experience, because I did work at Rikers Island for a bit, how the inmates who don't have mental health conditions might exploit or, you know, or cause harm to them as kind of more vulnerable individuals, right? So these are some of the things that I kind of see. I don't know if there's any other parallels that you see with the present day in terms of this combining corrections and charities.
Well, I'm more knowledgeable about the 19th century.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I did look at where we are today, and it mm-hmm. was just, you know, what I thought was just beyond belief horrible. It just seemed to get worse as time went on. Everything that I looked at got worse. Like when they bought Rikers Island, once again, they were going to fix, they recognized that, okay, we screwed up again. Rikers Island, and we're going to fix everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then they built a workhouse and a penitentiary to replace the ones on Blackwell's Island, and then just made all the same mistakes. And the only difference I could find was they had plumbing.
Right.
It's terrible. What you could probably speak to, but in the 19th century, at least in the beginning of the 19th century, they made putting the mentally ill in prisons and jails illegal. Like, you could not do that, but apparently now you can. You know, I think about when they started building on Rikers Island, they put this note in the cornerstone for, I believe, the penitentiary at the time. And they knew that they had screwed up, and they wrote this thing to the people of the future to, I had that quote, but I don't know if I have it handy. Yes, they knew they were going to be judged. So they hoped the recrimination to come would be, and now I'm quoting them, tempered by the thought that we did the best we knew how in the light of such knowledge and understanding as was given us. So they're basically going, we did the best we could with what we knew, and sorry.
Yeah. And so that sort of suggests that, you know, closing Rikers as a solution to the horrors that exist on it, right? And there have been many deaths that have occurred in the last year, you know, is maybe another, you know, step into, like, we're going to do the best that we can with what we know, but not really getting to fundamental issues that lead it to become, you know, something that that makes people be mistreated and, you know, more likely to die.
Yeah.
So that's a really powerful quote. Do you think that people who work at Rikers Island have any idea that that's what's kind of there in the foundation?
No.
Yeah. It was never shown to me or told to me when I went to work there. So a lot of people are familiar with the Nellie Bly story. That's kind of one of the most familiar parts of the Blackwells kind of story to the average person who hasn't read your book. But something I just kind of want to point out is, like, you know, there's this sort of tradition of scandal being the driving force for, you know, change, I guess. And, you know, Blackwell's Island was sort of like an open secret, but it wasn't until Nellie Bly's book that, you know, people kind of got up in arms about it. And then that led to eventually it being closed and things being relocated onto Ward's Island completely, right? So they were both, as you know, if someone's read my book, they know that there was the men's asylum on Ward's Island for a period, and there was the women's on Blackwell's Island, and then that was closed, and then everybody was going to be on Ward's Island from then on. But so Nellie Bly's book, you know, was the impetus for this. So why is it that that policymakers are so, you know, responsive to the scandal, you know, I guess when it's called out in the press, but other times just kind of, you know, ignore what they already know?
Well, if it's not in the press, there's really, they don't seem to be motivated by their conscience. But the exception to that would be, I read all the annual reports for the departments, and I'm sure you must have read the same.
Yes, I did. Yeah. And they were saying this year after year, we're overcrowded, we're underfunded.
Yeah. I was kind of surprised because I'm so used to reading annual reports that are written now, and they're just PR. They don't really give you any information.
Yeah. No, these were honest statements.
Yeah.
So
you found compassion there. Mm-hmm. So the compassion was lacking, as far as I could tell, was with the commissioners of the Department of Public Charities and Correction, who never responded year after year when they read these reports of the horrors that were going on and the need for money, and did not give more money or any kind of help year after year after year until it was in the press. And it was in the press a lot prior to Nellie Bly.
So how did that make it the tipping point, I guess?
Well, because she was on the inside as a patient. It made all the difference in the world. People were more apt to say, like, there were reports, like, it was like in all the news about like 15 years before, and that led to a Senate investigation. These horrible talks of death. Like, I talked about one case where a woman who was pregnant was put in a straitjacket and thrown into solitary. And just the fact that a place where they were treating people for mental health issues had solitary confinement. I mean, what? So they put a pregnant woman in a straitjacket in solitary and basically forgot about her. And she gave birth, while in a straitjacket alone. And that story got out. So it led to a Senate investigation. And they talked to tons of people, you know, doctors and people who worked there, but they didn't talk to any patients. And anybody that told them, you know, how terrible it was, as if that one story wasn't enough, they didn't believe them. They believed the doctors, and they believed the nurses. And the nurses were often the people who were responsible for the most abuse. And when I say nurses, I don't mean nurses as we understand them today. They were called nurses, but not until towards the end of the century were they actually trained nurses. They were convicts. So I forgot where I was going.
The important thing was
they believed Nellie Bly.
Yeah. And so, so I guess that points toward the credibility of the storyteller, right?
Yeah.
Is important because Nellie Bly, as a person who they identified as not really insane, right? So if somebody who had been in the hospital spoke of abuses, their story would be dismissed, perhaps, right?
Oh, it was. Yeah. They're just crazy people.
So she told the same type of story, and it wasn't dismissed because she was not considered to not be insane. And but she had also had that direct experience. She wasn't just relaying it, you know, something that she heard. So we want to hear stories from people on the inside, but then how do you get that, right, without it being something that could be discredited, right? You know, so I'm a stigma researcher, and we talk about how, you know, stigma is this thing that leads people to be discredited, right?
But they didn't believe anyone that didn't tell them the story that they wanted to hear. For instance, one of the main people in my book was an Episcopal priest, Reverend William Glennie French.
Mm-hmm.
And he testified, and they didn't believe him either. He said, these nurses do what they want, and they're almost killing people. He talked about, you know, two nurses holding a woman's head underwater.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if a priest was incredible, you know,
exactly,
who would they listen to? Somehow, a person having that direct experience was something that they would, that people finally listened to. Yeah. So like an interesting kind of parallel story I just wanted to mention. I don't know if you've ever heard about the, this is not something that I notified you would be talking about. Have you ever heard about the Greek island of Leros?
I've heard of it, but I know nothing.
Yeah. So there was, it's a really interesting story. So an asylum was opened there in 1957. And it was kind of like set up, they call it the Psychopaths Colony of Leros, right? It's kind of a distant island from, you know, the mainland. It's in one of the Dodecanese, it's close to Turkey, right? They determined they would send people there who had no visitors for like a year, right? So basically it became like the dumping ground of people who had not been visited by their families from the mainland. And it was known to have horrible conditions. And this was something, it was like an open secret, similar to kind of how things were with Blackwell's. But it wasn't until a British journalist visited it and published his investigation in The Observer, and it was under the title of Europe's Guilty Secret, with photos, some of which were actually like older photos, but it kind of didn't matter because everybody knew that the essence of it was accurate, that, you know, Greece kind of decided that they had to close this, you know, institution. Ironically, it ended up becoming refugee camp in more recent years, right? So it's sort of like been reborn, you know, in terms of housing inhumanely a new group of people. But I guess the kind of story I'm saying is like, this is not as long ago as you wrote about in your book, you know. And you know, Greece is it's in the European Union, it's you know, not as high income as some other countries in Europe, but it was still kind of like they knew about it. They thought they were getting away with it until like a Brit came and, you know, wrote about it in something and exposed it to the rest of Europe.
Oh my God. What? Mm-hmm. So when 1957 is when the journalist.
Well, no, 1957 is when it opened. 1989 is when he published his account.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it kind of like made me think like, well, this is kind of, he didn't go in and pretend he was a patient. He just went there, took photos, right? So it wasn't quite a parallel to what Nellie Bly did. But, you know, I'm just sort of thinking about like, there's this kind of recurring.
Well, you know about Willowbrook, right? The
sure, of course. Geraldo Rivera. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah. No, I've seen it. That definitely launched his career. And he snuck in, right? He went in, started taking photos. Yeah. Yeah, so that was on Staten Island and in the 70s.
Yeah.
So again, there's this pattern, this recurring pattern of, you know, scandal being, you know, the driving force. But people knew about these things, right?
Well, that's what I was saying. There had been plenty of articles and people knew exactly what was going on Blackwell's Island. But I mean, it's like now people know that we are now guilty of all sorts of horrors in so many arenas, not just mental health and we don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard to find out, to really point to who are the bad guys, who's responsible. It's like we all are. Like, and that was actually a real thing with my book. Like, when I say real thing, like, you know, I'm trying to tell a story. Like, who is the bad guy? Who can I point to? And I remember thinking that this guy, this doctor named Strew, who was there during the absolute worst period of the asylum. So I was like, I was so sure he was a bad guy. But then when I started, you know, digging deep into him, it was just the opposite. He had actually tried to institute humane conditions, you know, less putting people in restraints. He tried to cut down on the abuse, and he fired people if they wouldn't stop. And those people would go to the commissioners, and they would rehire him. And then, so then he had like everybody against him because, you know, they wanted him out because he was trying to fix things. He was making them work harder, and so he ultimately was shoved out of his job. He was the
Sounds like a profile in Courage.
good guy.
Right? Yeah. But
Yeah.
so maybe the commissioners were the bad guys. I
Well,
mean,
that, yes. And I found one good, was it one good commissioner? Like at a certain point, the commissioner started getting a reputation, and journalists were focusing on them. So I think that towards the end, there were three commissioners. At one point, there was five. The number changes, and so they brought in this commissioner. I can't remember his name, but he had a compassion. He was a doctor, I believe, and had a compassionate background to like clean up their image.
Yeah, and it seems like you know, maybe the populace or the wealthy of New York, you know, bear responsibility as well, because you know, maybe this extends to the present day. The city's always been a wealthy place, right? With a high concentration of the wealthiest people in the country. But you know, in your book and in mine, you know, we talk about how they spent less per person, you know, than most other places in the country, you know, to for this quote unquote care that they were
Yeah.
getting. And you know, it was they didn't want to raise taxes, or they didn't want to divert things from other budget items, you know, so perhaps that's part of it, is like this responsibility of, you know, not of unwillingness to be taxed at a level that would really meet the needs of the city.
That's a big part of it. Again, it really is a ma like we have all these biases that exacerbate the problem, but the fact that we were unwilling to spend what it will cost to do a good job in everything, in corrections, in hospitals, everything to do with the poor, we spend as little as we can get away with. And this, I track this in my book, like they kept lowering and lowering and lowering, for instance, what they spent feeding these people to the point that they were starving.
And people were sleeping on straw.
Yeah. I mean, it reads like a horror story doing research on this. I'm sure you found the same thing. And like, and it's just so sad. Like I talk about people being forgotten. This one doctor was hired. I forget. I wish I had a better memory. I forget what year, but he came in and he tried to clean things up. And one of the first thing he did was go through the records of everyone that was in the asylum at the time. And I can't remember the exact number, but roughly 100 people were there without records. They don't know how long they were there. They don't know what brought them there, like what diagnosis or what diagnosis they had now. They basically were continuing to house them, but they were not doing anything for them.
Perhaps they had no need to stay there any longer, right? Who knew,
Yeah.
right? So based on the subjects of your last few books, you know, including your current one, you know, it seems like you're really passionate about writing books about New York City. And maybe to add this, you know, sort of like hidden aspects of New York City's history or story, in a sense, right? So like East New York, the topic of your latest book. I mean, you know, a lot of New Yorkers don't even know where
Yeah,
East New
it
York
has
is, right?
that.
So what draws you to wanting to uncover, you know, these stories about unknown aspects of New York City's history?
Well, I talked a little bit about this need to resurrect The forgotten. But I've always been like this. Ever since I was a kid, I was like this, drawn to these kinds of stories and just and but also very much drawn to New York. I grew up on Long Island, and that was torture for me. But we would go into the city, every so often, and to me it was like this magical, wonderful place. And I never forgave my parents for putting us on Long Island when the greatest city in the world was this close. But my mother tells a story of me as a child that I love this story. I don't remember this thing happening, but my grandfather was a judge in New York, and he took me and my brothers and some of my cousins to the courthouse to give us a tour. And we were outside in front of the building, and he was telling us some things about the courthouse. And my mother said, I immediately just started pelting him with questions, like, how long has it been like this? What do they do in there? Who's in there? Tell me. And he loved answering my questions so much that he left all my brothers and cousins outside, and I was the only one that got inside to have this tour. But I'm always like that. Like, my favorite thing in the world is to just find, like, open a box that nobody's opened for decades, or go into a closet that's been closed and nobody knows what's inside. I love this. I found these kinds of stories when I was writing about the police department's cold case squad opening, cold cases that were like 100 years old that nobody's looked at. It's a treasure hunt to me, and a treasure hunt of New York stories, for whatever reason, for me, is the best of all. In fact, the book, Damnation Island, originally my plan was to write a book about the municipal archives, which I'm sure you've been there. And it's one of my favorite places to go because, and I'm sure this has happened to you as well, like, you'll be researching one thing and then you come across something else. And it's like what people experience on the internet. You end up going down this rabbit hole, following all these different stories. And I thought somehow I wanted to write a book showing how that happens, like going from collection to collection and just showing what's in there, because it's endless, endless stories. And in the proposal I wrote, there was a story about a young boy that was found wandering the streets of New York in terrible condition. And the description that was written by the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, they said his leg was so rotten, it was almost coming off.
Oh my God.
And he ended up on Randall's Island in the children's hospital. And that brings me to another thing. Like, I love that you wrote your book, because when I was writing my book, like, so my publisher said, oh, the Blackwell's Island sounds really interesting. Why don't you just write about that? And I said, oh, great idea. So as I started researching Blackwell's Island, I of course came across all the other islands where the city had buildings, and I thought, I want to research all of them. I want to write about all of them. But then that would have been a billion page book. But it frustrated me because the stories look just as good. So when I got sent your book, I was very excited to read it.
Yeah, and as an aside, so the Children's Hospital was located on Randall's Island, right? Where people know of as like Icon Stadium and those things are there. And that was very quickly demolished by Robert Moses because he had that power because it was run by the city, right? So he didn't succeed in, as I talk about in my book, in getting rid of the Manhattan State Hospital that was on Ward's Island because the state kind of was able to resist that. He didn't have as much of a direct power with the state. But yeah, the Children's Hospital, that was it. It was gone. I'm sure there was a lot of, things going on there that can be talked about by someone else, but it met a different fate than the institutions of Ward's Island.
That's the end of today's episode of Exiles in the City. I want to thank my guests for joining me and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, please subscribe to the Substack to be informed of when future episodes are released. Please spread the word. Thank you and stay strong.